is season 5 of Libya Matters. Join Elham Saudi, Mara Mohammed, Mara Ben Abdelrazak, and Mae Thompson for a Women, Peace and Security Takeover. This season, we'll reflect on topics including gender considerations, protections, women's rights, and our participation in political and peace processes. We'll be bringing you compelling conversations with women from Libya, Afghanistan, Iran, Sudan, and other global majority countries to help us think about not only the importance of upholding the Women, Peace and Security agenda, but also how to overcome current challenges and barriers to women in conflict and post-conflict settings. Before we dive into today's episode, we want to give you a heads up. Our discussion may include sensitive topics and personal experiences that could be distressing for some listeners. Some of the guests this season include women in different parts of the world who have been imprisoned, tracked, spied on, and attacked for the work they're doing. For this reason, this episode was recorded remotely, which means there'll be some variations in the sound quality. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Libya Matters with me, Mae Thompson.
And me, Marwa Ben Abdelrazak. In today's episode, I'm looking forward to zooming into a particular aspect of the Women, Peace and Security agenda, to prevent and address conflict-related violence against women and girls. Conflict-related violence refers to acts of violence that are committed during armed conflicts or in post-conflict settings, including but not limited to rape, sexual slavery, forced prostitution, forced pregnancy, and other forms of sexual violence. The elimination of violence against women and girls requires efforts from all fronts, including from government bodies, intergovernmental organizations, and judicial systems. Over the years, we've seen policies and laws focus on the criminalization of violence against women and girls globally, but shortcomings remain in the enforcement of these frameworks to effectively prevent such violence and ensure roads to justice. What are the obligations for stakeholders under the WPS agenda to protect and promote the safety and security of women and girls in conflict-affected countries? And how can national and international policymakers best engage with local and regional women's rights networks and organizations, providing support to victims and communities affected by violence against women and girls?
To help us answer these questions, we are joined by Hala Al-Karib, women's rights defender, researcher, and the regional director of SIHA, the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa Network, an organization established in 1995 by a coalition of women's rights activists with the aim of strengthening the capacities of women's rights organizations and addressing women's subordination and violence against women and girls in the Greater Horn of Africa. Hala serves as the editorial head of the SIHA journal, Women in Islam, an annual journal published by SIHA that focuses on gender relations and women's rights within Muslim communities. She is a board member of Musawa, a global movement working on reforming Muslim family law, and she is a fellow with the Rift Valley Institute, an organization operating in Eastern and Central Africa dedicated to incorporating local knowledge into social, political, and economic development efforts. Welcome, Hala, to Libya Matters. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me, and I really appreciate your efforts.
Hala, it's wonderful to have you with us. You know, every time we bring someone into the podcast, I'm always eager to hear about the personal side of their journey. What's the story behind the commitment to women, peace and security? Was there a light bulb moment when you knew this was your calling?
So I think it's usually a journey, you know, for women. I mean, born into an environment of subordinations, it takes you a very long time and being indoctrinated as, you know, as someone who is less of a human due to culture, traditions, and patterns of upbringing, you know, but also I think it extends beyond the family. It goes all the way also to the society, to the state, to policies and laws, to family laws and traditions, you know, and you find yourself constantly in conflict with your surroundings, and you find yourself constantly fighting for humanity. And if you know, if you are exposed also to the West and you traveled abroad, you would easily find out that, you know, there is an extra layer of subordination you also have to fight against, you know, your identity, you know, as an African woman, for me, as identity as an African woman, as a Muslim woman, you know, as a woman from a very poor country. This is, as I said, it's a journey navigating through those layers and layers of subordinations and constantly fighting for humanity, for your rights and identity as a full human being. It creates a different person of you, someone who is quite, I mean, it definitely, it makes you strong, but it makes you also aware, you know, and quite sensitive to injustice, to subordinations, to discriminations.
Yeah, it's fascinating, actually, what you've mentioned. And I think, yes, it's a journey for women who lived in traditional societies. And as you say, those traditional societies are filled, unfortunately, for women with many challenges. It makes you, and also you've mentioned a very good point, those challenges make you aware of many things. And I think this takes us to the other question that I had in mind. I felt like it's pretty interesting that Saiha, the scream, I wanted to know the philosophy behind that linguistic choice.
The name is the strategic initiative for women in the Horn of Africa. This is our name. This is and it's an initiative that started by a group of women from the Horn of Africa, simply from Sudan, from Somalia, from Ethiopia, from Eritrea, from Djibouti, from South Sudan. And it's women activists and you know, very women community leaders and women peace activists who decided that this particular region within the continent has its own challenges. And, you know, the Horn of Africa is a very interesting region because it's a region that was exposed to different cultural influences. First of all, it's an East African region, but it's also influenced a lot by Northern Africa and by the Sahel region. And it's also exposed to the Middle East and to the Arab Peninsula because of geographical proximity. And it is quite fascinating and very rich in terms of culture, but also has very specific characteristics. And the majority of the population in this region, they are either Muslims or affected by Islam in a way, historically, and things like that. So the patterns of violence against women and the political violence that's happening in this region, it has a specific feature, but it's also not recognized, you know, the violation that's happening to the women by Northern Africa, by Western Africa, or by Eastern Africa. So those group of activists, they have decided that, you know, in this particular region, we really need to be able to speak up and to reflect, you know, what's happening to us in terms of patterns of and drivers of violence. And so they came together in the mid-1990s. They established SIHA. So they established SIHA, and it was a self-driven initiative. Those women, they used their own resources to travel to meetings, to meet each other in different cities, wherever it's safe. And, you know, it continued as just an activist initiative until the early 2000. And then some donors, particularly Oxfam Novib, they took interest on it, on this particular network of women activists. And then it grew from there. So, and then the acronym of SIHA or SIHA in Arabic, you know, it was adopted by everyone. And in our definition, we say our acronym is SIHA, which is, means the outcry, bringing more attention to the issues of women in that particular region.
And in terms of, you know, in this fight against or in this fight to eliminate those forms of violence and violence against women more generally, just clarify maybe the difference between violence against women and girls and sexual and gender-based violence, the difference in the use of those terms as well, I think would be great.
I think violence against women, it's a political question. When I say it's a political question, because it's very much connected and linked to the political structure that dictates and control, you know, and enable this violence to happen. And I think you cannot be, you know, we can't address and challenge violence against women by separating or prioritizing violence and say this violence is worth thing, this one we can put behind. It's absolutely an issue that has to be addressed fundamentally while we are, you know, navigating the struggle for equality and justice for women and girls. Because it has so many manifestations, you know, it's, you know, our full humanity is actually conditioned by our ability to delegitimize, you know, the forms of violence that we are experiencing in our daily life. And just if you start thinking about it, waking up in the morning, walking on the streets in any part of the world, you know, even if you are in the developed world, you know, as African women, as Black women, you know, we can detect, you know, patterns of violence that we are experiencing, how we have been undermined constantly. So it's absolutely a fight of our, for our humanity and for our peace and security.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. And I wanted to see if you could just go a little bit further on, or maybe reflect on those challenges that you mentioned, this very unique set of challenges facing women in East Africa, and maybe how they have changed perhaps between when the organization was founded, you know, in the 90s and today.
So it became more complex, absolutely, you know, because we are a region that exposed, you know, first of all, it's we are poor, not in terms of resources. It's very rich region when it comes to natural resources, but it's poor in terms of the capacity to utilize its resources, and then the, you know, unstable governance. So that has made the region more exposed to become a playground for, you know, for the politics of surrounding countries. Just an example, for a very long time, the region has struggled with religious militancy and fundamentalism in countries like Somalia, like Sudan. And that's basically happening because it wasn't easy to use as a backyard by the time where indoctrinating local and indigenous populations of the region and manipulating them by using religion just to make them under the control of certain countries, particularly the Gulf countries. You know, Saudi Arabia has played a fundamental role, especially by training of conservative and militant religious leaders in the region who spread it very specific ideology, and that has contributed a lot to the destabilizations of countries like Somalia, and it has made Somalia more susceptible to militants. So this would be one example. It also influenced Sudan largely by also making Sudan for years falling into the grip of religious fundamentalists groups for almost three decades. And that has led to specific patterns of violence against women has become quite prevalent in those countries.
I was just going to pause you there. Could you tell us, practically speaking, I know Mara mentioned some at the top, but what does these patterns of sexual violence look like for everyday women?
sexual violence in the Horn of Africa, it starts with patterns of repressing and undermining women, and it starts with, you know, the challenges such as forced marriage, for example, which is quite prevalent. It starts with forced child marriage. So the traditions and culture that has formed during the 1990s, 1980s, and that was the main driver of establishing SIHA, that led to the alienation of women, alienation and discrimination against women. It became part of the identity by communities. Then different patterns of violence against women starts to emerge, you know, because central into these ideologies, you know, is the subordination, is the dehumanization of women, is the fact that women are less of a human beings. So sexual violence is coming from the fact that women have been dehumanized to a large extent. You know, the fact that women has lost their rights, for example, to choose who they be with, and so on. And then when you do that, you know, you tend to make it easier for crimes such as sexual violence against women to happen. And especially when you don't have and you don't acknowledge the fact that you need a legal framework to protect women and girls from those crimes, because the type of legal frameworks that you develop, it's a framework that's based on literally gender apartheid. It's based on the fact that women should not be existing in public spaces. And if they exist in public spaces, then whatever happened to them, it's their fault.
Hello, I'm Rahima, Communications Officer at LFJL. In this LFJL Explains, I'll be talking about legal frameworks surrounding violence against women and girls in the context of Libya. In 1989, Libya acceded to the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW. This is often described as the International Bill of Rights for Women, as it outlines principles for gender equality and aims to eliminate discrimination against women in all areas of life. It's worth noting that despite acceding to the convention, Libya entered reservations on a few articles, including the right to non-discrimination and non-discrimination in all matters relating to marriage and family relations. These again were raised in 1995, when Libya submitted a new general reservation that the treaty's implementation cannot conflict with personal status laws derived from Sharia. This ultimately undermined the purpose of the convention, and this move drew criticism from states around the world. During the Gaddafi period, several laws and policies were implemented that perpetuated gender inequality and failed to protect women from violence. Revisions to Libya's 1954 Penal Code didn't address discriminatory articles such as Article 424 that states, if an offender marries a woman against whom the offence is committed, the offence and penalty shall be extinguished. Fast forward to today. Since the uprising in 2011, violence against women and girls, including sexual violence, has been perpetrated in Libya with absolute impunity. The breakdown of the rule of law, the prevalence of criminal networks such as traffickers and armed groups and access to arms has built an environment where violence is rampant, and the Libyan state's inability to control these groups have left women vulnerable. On the 19th of February 2014, 3 years after the uprising, the Libyan Minister of Justice adopted a decree recognizing victims of sexual violence perpetrated during the revolution in Libya as victims of war. The final report of the Independent Fact-Finding Mission in Libya, FFM, published in March 2023, also detailed the continual and wide use of SGBV by Libyan state actors. Since 2014, women human rights defenders have been routinely subjected to gender-based violence, including physical assault, abduction, sexual violence. There are no effective domestic frameworks currently in place to address these rampant violations. To find out more about violence against women and girls, check out our website, libyanjustice.org.
So just to answer your questions, you know, about the patterns and drivers of violence against women and girls in the region. What I meant to say specifically is that it's not separated from the politics, and it's not separated from the influence, you know, that the region has been exposed to as the result of the geopolitics around us. And I am someone who strongly believes that violence against women and sexual violence, which we all agree, are absolutely 100%, you know, a political issue. And it has to be approached from that angle. During the 1970s and 60s, this region has been relatively stable, and it has had potentials of, you know, becoming more or less part of the world to contribute to the African continent and so on. But the exposure of that region, you know, to the different geopolitical forces, you know, particularly in the Gulf countries, you know, and Northern Africa, you know, speaking about the influence of Egypt, of course, you know, who largely disrupted, you know, the transformation of Sudan into democracy for decades. It's actually led, you know, to this level of disintegration that the region is struggling with.
Yeah, it makes perfectly sense. And I wanted to touch base on something important. I mean, all the things that you mentioned, of course, they are important. The religious discourse and the interference of the religious discourse in the fight for the WPS agenda. And I mean, we're working on women and peace and security in Libya, and we're facing the same challenge. The interference of conservative groups, religious groups in the women, peace and security agenda. And I think, I mean, this problem we're facing in the whole MENA region. How can we work on a counter narrative approach to face the narrative or the conservative discourse that we're seeing?
No, I don't think it's a MENA region issue. I think it's a, you know, if you look across Africa, you know, if you look at Somalia, if you look at Sudan, if you look at Muslim communities in Ethiopia, who are over 40% of the population, if you look at Nigeria, you know, who has a considerable number, northern Nigeria, of Muslims populations, you know, this is definitely one of the drivers of violence against women. But this is also this type of narrative and environment, the way it was constructed. It was constructed as a result of very specific influences. And for me, it's really important to kind of address and be able to speak about the fact that this construct that was created, it's a political construct. It doesn't represent our identity or our culture. It was something it was an ideology that was introduced to us, you know, at certain point in time. And then people, they assume that this is who we are. This is our religion and this is our faith. And I think it's very, very important for us to kind of reclaim who we are, reclaim our identity, reclaim our faith and our religion, you know, and reclaim justice as well. Shape it the way, you know, it respects our humanity and our equality. And that's very, very important, because when you undermine women, when you undermine their human rights, when you undermine their equality in society, you undermine democracy, and you use women. And this is what happened in the case of Sudan, that the Sudan political Islamists have used women to interrogate and intimidate society for a number of years by positioning themselves as the protectors of women, and they are, and as the protector of women against, you know, the influence of Western civilization and so on. And this is happening across the Muslim world. And I think right now the challenges that we are facing and we are encountering expose that this type of narrative cannot be, you know, sustained, and that as women, we can't continue to be intimidated or to be afraid of this type of narrative. So I think we are at a very critical time where, you know, this repressive narrative is losing legitimacy and it's falling apart. I think it's very important for the women activists, you know, not to be afraid or not to be intimidated by this type of narrative that assume or presume that women's subordinations and injustices is part of religious or national identity. I think we are very much have an opportunity to very strongly reclaim who we are, you know, being Muslim women, being Muslim African women, or being Muslim Middle Eastern women, and, you know, and to speak about justice. And we have a lot of resources and a lot of scholarship and a lot of political arguments to stand against this alienating narrative.
Absolutely. And you spoke there about women activists being brave, and we do know what so much of what you're saying does resonate so deeply in Libya. And what we also see is that women's rights defenders, women that do speak out, they do face severe reprisals. There is that security risk whenever they choose to fight against this narrative or this system of oppression. And I wanted to ask you about sort of the legal frameworks that we have. You sort of touched on them earlier, and I know very recently you addressed the Security Council during their open debate on women, peace and security, and your statement focused on the sort of consequences of the international community failing to uphold the women, peace and security agenda. Where I want to ask you, where do you see the international community? What specifically, or what are the key areas in which the international community is failing women in, you know, in the Horn of Africa, in the Muslim world, in all countries affected by conflict? And what should they be doing? How can they better facilitate sort of the upholding of those legal protections?
Well, I think, you know, the international community is perceiving us, sometimes I feel, as not worthy of, you know, of being supported, and kind of, as, and I'm saying that as African women, and the fact that the patterns of violation that we are experiencing, it's literally being normalized as if it's a norm, you know, that that women in this part of the world should be exposed to violence and to sexual violence, and it's kind of stigmatizing our societies as being violent societies. And this is why you would see the different reactions, for example, when violence against women in conflict and post-conflict situations happens in countries like, you know, like Sudan, like South Sudan, or Somalia, or Libya, or Yemen, you know, versus when this violence occurs in the within the global north. So the reaction is completely different, because in the conscious of and the narrative of the international community that we are violent societies, and what we're doing, you know, it's kind of normal. And this is this type of construct, you know, our hope is that it should be constantly challenged by, and of course, what's happening in Palestine at the moment and in Gaza. Our hope, you know, as activists, it's for it to be challenged by the by the international law, by the international human rights law and the international humanitarian law, and by the commitments to these frameworks, which is quite a struggle, you know, and it is quite frustrating as well in terms of getting reactions and the response from those mechanisms. That in itself is a massive challenge, because that it sends a message, a clear message, to the forces of chaos and forces of terror within our regions that they have a license to do whatever they want to do without any, you know, repercussions for their actions. It's extremely worrying. I think it's a very, very difficult moment for women, peace and security agenda at this point in time, because as women activists and as women leaders, our only framework, what we have is our voices, and as peace activists, you know, and as anti-war activists, what we have is our voices. What we have is the, you know, is the humanitarian and human rights framework, and we cannot afford those framework failing to fall apart. So I think we have right now, as women front line defenders and activists, we have multiple responsibilities. So in addition to amplify the voices of our communities and of women grassroots and women on the grounds, we need also to stand up for the human rights and humanitarian framework, because those are not Western constructs. Those are constructs that as developing countries as countries in the South, we also contributed to them.
I absolutely agree. There does need to be accountability for all actors, right? We are seeing this backsliding in respect for international law, human rights law, humanitarian law, you know, for resolutions, for example, such as those under the Women, Peace and Security agenda at the Security Council. So thank you so much for those insights. I'll pass back over to Mara, because I think she wants to pick up on that.
Yeah, we've seen, for example, the NGO Working Group on Women, Peace and Security, the consultations, the Civil Society and Women's Rights Network by the Security Council, reflecting on those interactions, how do you see the strengthening of these partnerships to ensure that women's organizations and women activists not only have a seat at the table, but are also adequately protected and empowered in their critical work?
So the representation, it's proven that it's not enough. You know, it's critical and important, but only having women without the gender, it's, you know, it's not about being present, but it's about being present with an agenda. I think limiting the conversations to percentage of representations without addressing the fact that representation, if it's not coming with clear agenda on behalf of the women that we are representing, usually it is counterproductive. And that's definitely one of the challenges that, and one of the issues that we are navigating within the movement. While we have and continue to demand 50% representations from beginning to end, we should also continue to push for representation that reflects on the challenges that women are encountering. We have done a lot of research with women in Sudan prior to this ugly and awful war that's happening against Sudanese people, this war that's driven, you know, by the geopolitics of the region. We have spoken to women, and what the women have said very clearly, they said that we demand to be present and to be part of the conversations from beginning to end. So don't bring us when everything is ready and set, you know, and you just say, here we are bringing some women, you know, to accessorize, you know, the political process, but we would like to make sure that we are part of the conversation from early on. And so far, you know, that is not happening, you know, in majority of our regions. The presence of women is limiting into certain positions at higher level. Presence of women in decision making from beginning to end, it is still a struggle.
Hala, I just wanted to pick up on your point when you mentioned we want women to have a meaningful participation. What does that mean practically? We don't just want them to take a seat, right, at the table. I think this is what you've meant. And I think, honestly, this is something that, I have a problem with the word meaningful. I feel like we need women to take a seat at the table. Yes, we want them to speak up about women's issues. Yes, but at the same time, we're limiting ourselves, right? We don't ask men to have a clear agenda to sit on the table and to participate in political discussions or negotiations, right? I think we're limiting ourselves with this approach.
So that's a good point, you know, but you shouldn't forget that it's not a playing field that we are standing on. You know, we are fighting our way, you know, every step of the way to reach that equal field where both of us are standing on the same, you know, where men and women are standing on the same ground. And that's not the case at the moment. And I'm actually very glad that you brought up this, because this is an ongoing conversation that I have with different generations of women, particularly the younger generations. We are in a status of a struggle. And when you are struggling, you are really, you know, you have to invest significantly to be able to interrogate and find your position within the current structure, which is a discriminatory structure. Nobody's going to just say, you know, join, come, because you don't have a system, you know, of governance that's actually enabling us, you know, including in the Western countries, by the way. There is lots of deception that is happening. But speaking about us, speaking about ourselves, we don't have a system that allows us to participate equally. And so for this reason, you know, you have to have your tools and you have to bear the responsibility of the struggle and you have to have the agenda. Because this is also a generational struggle. This is not a struggle that's going to end, you know, with us or with you or with the generations after you. You know, each one of us has a responsibility to hand in whatever we are working to accomplish. And even for my generation, we are standing on other women's shoulders, you know, who actually carried this flag of women, peace and securities and women, human rights and equality, and so on. So we don't, you know, compare ourselves, you know, what we do is we fight for our full humanity and for our full participations from beginning to end and for our agenda to transform and change, you know, this toxic environment, toxic power relations, you know, that generates all these conflicts, all this violence, you know. We are not competing over the same structure. We are, you know, trying to create a new structure that's based on peace, based on equality, you know, and respect of human rights and a structure that accommodates people for who they are, you know, not a structure. We don't want to find our place only on a structure that's based on repression. But it's a bigger fight, you know. It's a fight to influence the current construct and to replace it by more equitable, more egalitarian, and more fair, you know, construct.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And you touched on a point that we're not competitors and we're not competing with men and they're not our enemies, right? We're together in this fight for equality, for women, peace and security. Yeah, I wanted to ask you how important it is to engage with men. And in another episode, we've talked a lot about men allyship. How important it is for you to engage with men, not just as allies, but as functional actors in disrupting the patriarchy. How is SIHA network doing this? What have been the challenges?
So I mean, I think it's, you know, the what we're doing is it's an open it's an activism, you know, to influence change. And in that space, you know, there is many men who takes interest in being part of this. And some, they might take interest in being part of it and not all of it. But for us, you know, what's really the most important thing is to get as many women and as many women in their diversity, young, old, of different backgrounds, to take part in the struggle. And then the women can decide and the men can decide in terms of how to get involved. There is no set format. You know, if you want to engage, you know, in this platform, we are quite open, but definitely we are not losing our focus or our priority that we are here at this point in time, you know, to engage with women in their diversity.
Absolutely. And we know that violence against women and girls manifests differently in different contexts, but there is some universality to it. One of them being, you know, bringing in men to push the agenda forward. But I was wondering, as we start to bring this conversation to a close, are there any other universal aspects, you know, to this fight against violence against women and girls?
So violence against women and girls is the broader manifestations, you know, of dehumanization of women. It manifests in these systemic ongoing violations that women live through in many parts of the world, particularly in our parts of the world, because those violations have been legitimized. They have been justified, morally justified by religion, you know, by traditions, assuming that this is how women should be treated. And it creates these damaged societies that find it very difficult to navigate and find its way to peace and to democracy. Because if you continue to suppress and undermine over half of the populations, individuals who can contribute to the development, can contribute to every aspect of life, and to deny them their existence and humanity, then it's very difficult to create a peaceful society. Sexual and gender-based violence is one of the ugliest patterns of violence against women. And this is when women bodies are completely disregarded and used, you know, either as tactics to enforce power, or as tactics and strategies of war and conflict, you know, to undermine and humiliate societies. And this is It also happens, often it's happening right now in Sudan, where women bodies have been used as tactics of war and to intimidate and scare society, or just to eliminate and make women disappear, make their voices doesn't exist. You know, so sexual and gender-based violence has massive ramifications and massive impact. It doesn't end with victims or survivors. It goes beyond that, and it affects society, and it has a generational impact, absolutely.
We're now in the debunking the narrative segment. So this is a segment that we like to do at the end of each episode, where we ask our guests for their reaction to a common narrative surrounding their area of expertise. The statement we'd like you to respond to is this: traditional practices should not be changed, even if they are harmful to women and girls.
I mean, what is traditions? Traditions are human made. We are the one who create traditions, and we are the one who have the capacity to dismantle it and to reconstruct traditions. You know, traditions are not stagnant. You know, never they were stagnant issue. They were not written in stones. And it's just ridiculous that the word traditions doesn't show until we speak about women's rights. This is what it is, you know. So I always ask, I'm happy to speak about traditions and culture, and I have a lot of respect, but let us unpack this. What do we mean by tradition and culture? You know, so that's a question that we should always interrogate and ask. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the same term, traditions and meaningful participation, always come out whenever we talk about women, peace and security, and whenever we talk about equality. And for me, when I was reading, and when we were preparing for the debunking the narrative segment, I wanted to have some thoughts about it, and I wanted to say a few words honestly about it, because as a North African, Arab, Muslim woman, I struggled a lot with this narrative, because I feel like tradition is like roots of a tree, right? It's where we come from. It gives us our foundation. But when part of that root system starts to strangle the tree, instead of helping it grow, we've got to step in and do some pruning, right? We're talking about practices that hurt us, that hurt women and girls in those countries. Shouldn't we want to protect them, help them flourish? It's not about ditching our heritage. I mean, I'm really proud of where I am, from my heritage, from my country, but it's about making sure it serves the health and happiness of everyone. We adapt. That's what humans do best. Doesn't it make sense to carry forward the best of our traditions while leaving the harm behind?
I think it's also very, very important, Marwa, you know, to take into consideration that, you know, the whole idea of actually, you know, how does the roots look like? You know, who actually constructed and shared this idea with you that this is your roots, and how did it, who told you the story, you know? And this is basically the most important thing: who told the story and how the story was told. You know, the story was told by patriarchal institution. It was told, you know, women have completely different stories. And this is also part of the struggle. And this is why we have so many wonderful scholars who actually dig deeper into the history and come up with completely different stories and different narratives that was told by women, you know, and gave us actually different roots And this is really very, very important. Like, you know, is to look at how this was, it came together. And you constantly try to interrogate and not to assume that, you know, it's there is a formal, there is no formal story. Women are yet to tell their stories, and we already started. And that's the most important thing here.
Yeah. No, this is so insightful, and I could talk to you for hours. Really, this has started a conversation that I could really delve into and go down a whole total rabbit hole. But Hala, really, I think that's a lovely place to sort of end there. And I just wanted to thank you again so much. This really has given, I think, the both of us a lot to think about in our work on the, you know, women, peace and security, but actually on Libya, on the human rights situation in Libya as a whole. So thank you again so much.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And always keep telling your story and enable other women from Libya and from other parts of the world to tell their story as well. Thanks a lot for the space.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review and subscribe. You can find more information, including where to find us on social media, in the show notes. Libya Matters is brought to you by Lawyers for Justice in Libya and produced by Demiri Media. This season is hosted by Elham Saudi, Mara Mohammed, Mara Ben Abdelrazak, and Mae Thompson. It is produced and edited by Al Shebani, with sound design and mixing from Hafid Drabi. This season of Libya Matters was made possible by contributions from the LFJL team, including Alexandra Azua, Rahimna Abdelrazak, and Hasna Al-Jamali.